And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Barry Bradford, recognized as one of America's best teachers and public speakers. The Organization of American Historians named him as the best teacher in America. He has won awards from the President, the Congress, and leading civil rights organizations. He may be best known for leading teams of students in pursuing justice in the Mississippi burning cold case that led to the conviction of KKK leader Edgar Ray Killen. Plus, he has researched and lectured on a number of historical issues, including the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And Barry, thanks so much for returning to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be back here, and hello to everybody who's listening.
Tell you what, just 2 days ago, April 14th, was the 140th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln by the killer John Wilkes Booth. And while Booth fired the shot that killed the president at Ford's Theater on April 14th, 1865, there were other conspirators who helped pull the trigger. And before we look at Booth and the other conspirators, perhaps we should back up a bit. The assassination occurred just 5 days after the Civil War ended. What was the atmosphere like in Washington, D.C. after General Lee and the Confederate troops surrendered to Grant and the Union forces? What was that? What was going on there in Washington, D.C.?
Well, Washington, D.C. was the very picture of jubilation. D.C. itself was not far from the battlefields, and throughout the week, huge numbers of Union troops had come back, being received as heroes and being prepared to be mustered out of the service and going back to their various states. Every night, there were public celebrations, there were speeches, there were parades, there were bonfires lit everywhere. The whole city was illuminated. Every night, crowds would come onto the White House lawns and yell for Lincoln. He actually would come out and wave to them. On one occasion, made a brief speech that John Wilkes Booth listened to from underneath Lincoln's window. But the entire atmosphere of Washington, D.C. was best described as jubilant.
Now, conversely, in, say, Richmond, for example, the mood was quite different.
Well, anytime a country loses a war, the realization that life will never be the same is pretty profound. However, Lincoln had gone to Richmond on 10 days before. He had walked the streets and had been greeted by many very welcomingly. Others, of course, were more hesitant. But the key is that Lincoln had consistently, throughout the entire war, spoken of the people of the South as friends, as countrymen, as brethren. He spoke of them with respect and with kindness. And it's also incorrect to assume that all white people in the South were pro-Confederate. We know, for instance, when General Sherman liberated the city of Savannah, Georgia, that hundreds, if not thousands, of white men came out to cheer him and salute the flag. Just as there were Northerners who didn't support the war effort, there were Southerners who opposed the traitorous secession.
Moving back to Washington, D.C., that 5 days before he was killed and when the Civil War ended or concluded, what was Abraham Lincoln's outlook? Now, you mentioned that Washington, D.C. at the time was jubilant. What was Lincoln's outlook?
Lincoln was a man of extraordinarily deep thinking and deep feeling. He was possibly the most compassionate person ever to be president of the United States. He had a number of different emotional reactions. He was overjoyed that the war had ended because he wanted it over. He wanted the killing to stop. He wanted to work on the reunification of the country. But nowhere in Lincoln's public or private utterances is there gloating. There's more a sense of satisfaction that a horrible time is coming to an end. Secondly, Lincoln was very forward-looking. He was already focused on how to bring the southern states back into Congress, back into the Electoral College, back into voting, how to help the black people of the South who had been liberated, and how to rebuild the nation's economy. Finally, Lincoln was relieved. He had taken an enormous emotional beating throughout the war. Wars age presidents faster than anything else. And when you look at pictures of Lincoln before he assumed the presidency and afterwards, you see a man who has aged far, far more than his years would suggest. Remember that Lincoln was, at the time he was elected, one of the youngest presidents that we had ever had. He was just in his 50s when he was elected. Yet when you look at the pictures of him at the end of his life, he looks much older than that. He felt a sense of pride that the right cause had succeeded. Lincoln was determined to do right. The freeing of the slaves, the ending of a terrorist rebellion, the reunification of the country, these were noble goals, and Lincoln felt proud that they had accomplished at least the beginning of them.
And interestingly enough, retribution was not one of those goals.
No, not at all. Quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. In every public utterance and in many private letters and comments made to his cabinet, Lincoln did not want retribution. He understood that after a fight, you have the opportunity to make up. He knew that after the Civil War was done, the leaders of the terrorist rebellion would still be Americans, that they would, of necessity, still live in our country, and the choice was to treat them as a conquered people or to treat them as friends who had gone astray. And Lincoln, the man of compassion, but also the man of far-thinking magnitude, recognized that the way that this economy would grow, the way that our country would grow spiritually, emotionally, physically, and economically, was for all of us to unite behind a common American purpose. Therefore, he intentionally and purposefully avoided retribution. He sent signals to General Grant and to the other leaders of the military and the cabinet that he did not want the leaders of the terrorist rebellion to be prosecuted, to be harassed. Jefferson Davis in most countries would have been executed for being the leader of a terrorist group trying to overthrow the U.S. the government.
And same with
That's
General
where
Lee,
Lincoln
too.
Was coming yeah. from. Mm-hmm. Lincoln was coming from taking the long view. Lincoln always takes the long view.
And that's interesting. That was his outlook, the long view. And John Wilkes Booth, on the other hand, actor, Confederate supporter, what can you tell me about him? What sort of person was John Wilkes Booth, if we look inside
John
of him?
First of all, John Wilkes Booth was a very, very young man. He is the same age at the time of the assassination that Lee Harvey Oswald was when he shot President Kennedy. They're both young men, 23, 24 years old. Booth was a good actor and charming, charismatic, handsome, quite the ladies' man, athletic, strong, interesting. However, he had a blind spot. And this is true of many fanatics. It's been said that a fanatic is a man who won't change his mind and can't change the subject. And that certainly describes Booth on the subject of Lincoln, the South, and race. He was a fanatic. He saw no room for compromise, no room for compassion, no room for conciliation. He believed the South was all right, was glorious, and was terrific. He saw blacks as inferior and not worthy of his time, and his personal vitriol toward Abraham Lincoln was astounding. Booth was also a megalomaniac. He wanted to be famous. He wanted people to know that he had done it.
I just want to go back to that.
Nothing.
Just real quick.
He did absolutely nothing to cover up his involvement in the crime. He thought that he would be the American Brutus striking down Caesar, and was genuinely distressed at how alone and hunted he was after the assassination.
Back to Booth for a minute. I'm kind of curious, Barry. You said he had this incredible hatred, yet he came from a family, and I'm thinking of his father, Edwin Booth, very famous actor. Now, did his family have this kind of hatred for Lincoln like he did? I mean, where did this come from with Booth? That's what I haven't been able to pick up in any of the history books where deep inside it was rooted.
It's really intriguing. Lincoln, to the extent that he thought about John Wilkes Booth at all, admired him. An actor who knew Lincoln said that Lincoln was an admirer of Booth, that he had seen Booth perform at Ford's Theater and thought very well of him.
Hmm.
Booth, as you point out, came from a family that was pro-union. Booth's father and brother, also famous actors and more famous than John Wilkes Booth, were Lincoln supporters to the extent that they had any politics. Maryland was a border state. It was a slave-owning state that stayed loyal to the Union. Many white people in the state supported the Confederacy, so Booth's support of the terrorists is not in and of itself unusual. What is unusual is the depth of hatred within him, which is not easily explained. Booth and Lincoln never met each other. They never communicated with each other, although, as I pointed out, Lincoln had seen Booth perform. It was more the victim of a mind warped by fanaticism and influenced by terrorists.
Okay. Now, originally, though, Booth had intended, I believe, to kidnap Lincoln. Wasn't there a plot to do kidnap him before the Civil War ended? Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. One of the things that guaranteed the defeat of the terrorist rebellion was the fact that the United States, the North, as we think of it, had four times the population of the South. And not only that, there were millions of people in the South who were the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of kidnap victims who were being held against their will, exploited economically, physically, and sexually by people who said it was a peculiar institution. Peculiar institution is the term that the South used to justify holding the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of kidnap victims and using them to their economic gain. So as we look at this, as the war goes on, particularly once General Grant and General Sherman and General Sheridan take over the lead command roles of the Union Army, they recognize that the North, that the federal government, the United States of America, can win a war of attrition, that for every Union soldier who is killed, they can be replaced both by the superior population of the North and by the freed children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of the kidnapped victims, sometimes referred to as slaves of the South. The South couldn't replace their killed and captured and wounded soldiers. So Booth, working with the Confederate spy service, begins to devise various lunatic plots to kidnap President Lincoln and hold him for ransom. And the ransom that the South is intending to ask for is the return of Confederate prisoners of war. This would never have happened had they somehow managed to pull off one of these I Love Lucy level harebrained schemes that they had developed to kidnap the president. The Congress, the cabinet, and the military leadership would not have released terrorist prisoners. They would have unleashed more fury against the South. To give you a sense, though, of how ridiculous these plans were, one of Booth's plans was to kidnap Lincoln while he was attending the theater at Ford's Theater. That would involve Booth tying Lincoln up, pulling him over a balcony, lowering him down by a rope, where some of his conspirators would jump up out of the audience, take Lincoln and run out and put him in a carriage in front of 1,500 witnesses. The other night I was speaking about this, and there was a 10-year-old boy, very bright kid, in the audience, and I looked at him and I said, "Can you tell me what's wrong with this plan?" And this young fellow was able to identify half a dozen flaws in the plan. Lincoln wouldn't allow himself to be voluntarily tied up. Lincoln wouldn't have been alone in the box. There would have been other people in the theater who would have stopped it. Booth couldn't pick up Lincoln. There's a million things wrong with it. But here's the problem. The problem is that in Booth's head, it made sense. To him, it was this dramatic, emotional moment where he was going to prove that he was better than everyone. And he hatched a plan that couldn't work. After General Lee surrendered the main force of the terrorist rebellion, there was still one Confederate army in the field. That was the army of General Joseph Johnston. They were being chased by William Sherman. And Booth held out this vain notion that if they could, instead of kidnap Lincoln, kill him, kill the vice president, Andrew Johnson, kill Secretary of State William Seward, and kill Secretary of War Edwin Stanton all at the same time, that the Union would be thrown so into confusion that Johnston could get his army together and somehow win. It wasn't going to work, but it would have been a tremendous emotional shock to the country had Booth pulled it off.
You know, okay, so we're talking about they're going to murder the president, or there's this conspiracy to murder all those folks that you're talking about. And we're going to delve into that a little bit more in detail. But first, was there anything in the background to suggest, in Booth's background, to suggest that he was an assassin? I mean, we had talked last time you were here 2 years ago, we talked about Oswald. And, you know, he was trained with weapons. This is where I'm just a little confused with Booth. We go from actor to kidnapper to assassin in a very short period of time, correct?
No, not completely correct. his transformation takes time. Now, let's, again, consider the fact that he's a very young man at the time that he murders the president. So we can't say there's a 30-year track record any more than we can with Lee Harvey Oswald. However, what is absolutely undeniable in Booth's personality in his teenage years and his early 20s is an intense hatred of black people, an intense hatred of Lincoln, a tremendous love for the institutions of the South, a fanatic belief that he was right and always knew best. He had the physicality of an assassin. He was trained in stage combat, was an accomplished fencer, was an accomplished brawler, was an accomplished, a very good shot. Most of this comes through his stage training. And most important, this megalomaniac desire to be famous. One description of Lee Harvey Oswald by Stephen King is that he was a self-absorbed fame junkie. And you could say the same thing about John Wilkes Booth. The difference between Oswald and Booth being that Booth actually was, to an extent, famous at the time of the assassination. But Booth often acted in Shakespearean plays. And there are numerous references as you read about the planning to first kill the president, to be involved in the Confederate spy service, the murder of President Lincoln, the kidnapping of President Lincoln, that there is a constant reference to the play Julius Caesar, to the idea that Caesar, who had been popular, has become a tyrant, and that Brutus, speaking for the people, will slay him. Booth saw himself as an American Brutus. What he failed to learn from Shakespeare's writing was what fate would befall Brutus after the murder.
Exactly, exactly. You were referencing about the conspiracy regarding the other key players, and that would be, we've talked about Lincoln a little bit so far, but killing Vice President Johnson, Secretary of State William Seward, and also Secretary of War Stanton. And you know, let's talk a little bit about the other people involved with Booth. And I had said at the beginning of the interview that there were other conspirators who helped pull the trigger. And those folks are Lewis Payne or Powell. Seems to me whenever you're, depending on when the history book you're reading, his last name changes. So I guess we can either call him Payne or Powell for now, whatever works for you. And then George Atzerodt, Davy Harold, and Mary Surratt. What were their roles in the conspiracy to assassinate President Lincoln?
Each of them plays an interesting role, but before I go into them in
sure.
depth, it probably bears mentioning that the original conspirators who are planning on the kidnapping of Lincoln
yes.
Include other people, Samuel Arnold, Michael O'Loughlin, John Surratt, Mary Surratt's son, are all involved in the plot at one time or another. When it becomes clear that the war is ending, many of the members of the plot sort of melt away. They don't want to be involved in the murder of the president. They feel like it's a lost cause at that point.
Begin with Mary Surratt, though? Oh, go ahead.
Also known as Lewis Powell, as you point out.
Okay, yeah.
Goes by any variety of assumed names. Mm. He is a big, strong, violent man who dies at the age of 21.
Hmm.
He's only 21 years old at the time of the murder. He had been involved in the war. He had served with distinction for the Confederates. He also left the service at points due to depression. He had been kicked in the head by a mule. There are many reports about him that would suggest he was mentally handicapped mm-hmm. at the time of the assassination, that his thinking wasn't straight. He could not find his way in and out of Washington, D.C. on a horse. He had to be led by Davy Harold. What he does bring to the table, however, are several things. The first is an intense hatred of Lincoln, of the North, and of blacks. The second thing he brings is an extremely violent personality. And the third is a willingness to kill. Unlike the other two conspirators, Davy Harold and George Atzerodt, Payne has no compunction at all about killing people. And in the attack that he leads on the home of Secretary of State Seward, he stabs four different men, pistol whips a man, hits a woman. He just leaves carnage behind him. It is amazing that he didn't kill anybody that night.
And actually, we can talk a little bit about, when we get to that night, I guess I'm kind of leading up to that. We're kind of setting the stage, so to speak. Okay, so we have a little bit about a little bit of background about him. Not the brightest bulb, but still a killer, as you said.
Yeah.
I'd like to turn complete tables here, and even though she wasn't involved in the actual physicality of the crime, Mary Surratt. I just find her a curious figure, and we find out later she was the only woman in the United States history to be executed by hanging. And I guess we're taking a little bit of a detour here, but she was a figure in this conspiracy, and what was her role in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln?
Well, It's intriguing. Some years back, Robert Redford made a movie called The Conspirator about Mary Surratt. And he draws the conclusion that a few historians have reached that Mary Surratt was basically a dupe. Now, Robert Redford had a purpose in making the movie. He was trying to draw an analogy between the trial of the military trial of the conspirators with the military trials and imprisonment at Guantanamo Bay of terrorists from the Middle East. But if we put aside Robert Redford's political convictions and simply look at what Mary Surratt was doing, It's very clear that Mary Surratt was in this up to her elbows. Her boarding house in Maryland was a safe house used for meetings held by the Confederate Secret Service. Her son had become a courier for the Southern Spy Service. He moved illegal merchandise, cash, and messages back and forth and used his mother's home as his launching pad. Mary Surratt also owned a boarding house in Washington. She ran guns for Booth.
What does that mean, though? What does that mean, ran guns?
In her home, her son was part of the plot. This is not an innocent woman who is taken by surprise by any of this.
I just want to ask real quick.
Deeply involved.
Well, deeply involved, though, but running guns. I mean, ultimately, Booth used a derringer. So what does the running guns mean exactly in terms of her involvement?
Well, although Booth did use the derringer and a knife on the night of his attack, there were other weapons being used. Explosives were being moved in and out of Washington. There was a plot to blow up the White House. Mary Surratt conveyed messages and did everything that she could to help. It was in her home that this conspiracy was hatched. She carried information for the Confederate Secret Service. It takes a great leap of faith to suggest that she somehow didn't know anything that she was doing was wrong, or that anything being done in her presence was wrong. When they were going to kidnap Lincoln, for instance, which that plot was supposed to take place in March of 1865, Mary Surratt hid for them two rifles, ammunition, and other supplies. These are the weapons that are being moved around. They're part of a terrorist conspiracy. And if the Al-Qaeda attacks on the United States and other terrorist attacks such as the Boston Marathon bombing has taught us, is that aiding the conspiracy is the same thing as being part of the conspiracy itself. Mary Surratt was aiding a terrorist conspiracy to commit kidnapping and murder and to overthrow the government of the United States of America.
Tell you what, before we break, let's just talk about the other two conspirators, George Atzerodt and Davy Harold. We did talk about Lewis Payne or Powell. As you mentioned, he has several aliases. What was their function or responsibility or role?
Well, both of them were certainly Southern sympathizers. Both of them were very much enamored of John Wilkes Booth's glamour, mystique, charisma. Both of them had individual reasons to support the South. Neither of them, however, was a strong person. Atzerodt, a German immigrant, was an alcoholic who tried to get out of the kidnapping, tried to get out of the assassination plot once it turned from kidnapping to assassination. However, he still tries to go through with it. Davy Harold is a young kid. He's only 23. Atzerodt is the old man of the group. He's 30 years old.
Gee, that's something.
So these are young
kids.
People.
Yeah, very young.
And Davy Harold worked as a pharmacist assistant. This would, without going too deeply into the exact nature of the plot, help him gain entry into the home of Secretary of State Seward. And he eventually couldn't go through with much of anything either, but he was hanged along with Atzerodt and Payne and Mary Surratt.
Well, I tell you what, Barry, we're going to take a quick break, and I think we've set the table here. We're going to come back and turn to Black Friday, April 14th, 1865, after we take this break. If you're just joining us, my name is Jim Wunderlich. This is Word of Mouth, and we are talking to Barry Bradford, recognized as one of America's best teachers and public speakers. More about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, the 150th anniversary, after these words. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. And in the background, you hear the music of Abe and Johnny. And that is a song called Just Post Bellum, which can be interpreted as Justice After War. And that's the name of the group, Just Post Bellum. And the singers are Jeffrey Wilson and Hannah Jensen. And again, that's the song Abe and Johnny. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Barry Bradford, a noted historian, and we've been looking at the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln. And in the first segment, Barry, we talked about the conspirators along with John Wilkes Booth, and we had kind of set the table, and now are turning to Black Friday, April 14th, 1865. And historians have indicated that Lincoln was in an exceptionally good mood on that day. And I'm kind of curious, how did it come about that Mary Todd and Abe went to Our American Cousin at the Ford's Theater?
Lincoln loved the theater. He loved the theater. He did not have very much formal education at all. But among the many things that he loved to read was Shakespeare. Before the war, Lincoln loved attending Shakespeare and any dramas. However, his need to laugh and desire to create laughter was very profound, even at the worst of moments during the Civil War. Our American Cousin was scheduled to play at Ford's Theater on Good Friday night, 1865, and Lincoln wanted to go. By reputation, the play was very funny. It was a farce of mistaken identity. It starred Laura Keene, who was a very popular actress of her day, and in fact, the first woman in America to own her own theatrical production company. And Lincoln was anxious to see it. The idea of going for a few hours and just laughing and letting his worries go certainly appealed to him. It was hard for Lincoln during the war to get away, to not be involved with it. He felt it too deeply. And now that the war was over, he felt that he could let loose a little bit and laugh.
Now, their guests were Major Rathbone and Clara Harris. So they're in the box with them. And I guess we could talk more in detail about them as we go on. We've got to move ahead a little bit, though.
Clara Harris's background is fascinating,
okay.
And the reason she's in the box that night,
yeah,
it really tells you something about Mary Lincoln that you may not have known. The popular view of Mary Lincoln is that she is sort of an angry, shrewish, mentally ill character, and certainly all of those characteristics are evident in Mary Lincoln throughout her life from time to time, but Mary Lincoln had grown up without a mother. Mary Lincoln had felt the want of affection in her life from losing her mother. And she met Clara Harris. Clara Harris was a very young woman who was the daughter of a prominent senator. When Mary Lincoln met her, one of the things that attracted her to Clara Harris was the fact that Clara Harris had lost her mother when she was a young girl as well. So Mary Lincoln took Clara Harris under her wing and said, I'll kind of be your mother figure. What's fascinating about that is that when Lincoln couldn't get away to go to the theater, to the opera, to get out of the White House, it was not unusual at all for Mary Lincoln to contact Clara Harris and have her go with. So here's Mary Lincoln, who is about 25 years older than Clara Harris and can kind of serve as a substitute mother figure. Major Henry Rathbone, Clara Harris's fiance, was also, in a crazy, convoluted way, her stepbrother.
Yeah, that's wild.
And I'll just do this briefly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Clara Harris's father was a senator whose wife died when Clara was a little girl. Henry Rathbone's mother was a widow whose husband had died when Rathbone was a boy. His mother married Clara Harris's father, so he and Clara grew up in the same house together, although they weren't related biologically. And at the time of the assassination, the two of them were engaged to marry.
So the four of them are in the state box with Lincoln, I should say with Abraham and Mary Todd, the Lincolns. And I'm curious now, and this gets a little fuzzy, the bodyguard that was supposed to be at the state box, he kind of had an, not in terms of job description, he really didn't do the job. He was next door drinking, correct?
Well, exactly where he was and what he did is a matter of some conjecture. Mm. What we do know is that he wasn't at his post.
Right.
As I indicated, Mary Lincoln was only 47 years old at the time of the assassination, and she wasn't yet 50. She would live a long while afterwards. Clara Harris and Henry Rathbone would live a long time afterwards, although Rathbone ended up murdering Clara Harris and being committed to an insane asylum. In addition to the other three people in the box plus Booth, there were 1,500 people who witnessed the assassination. And one of the things that we know is that there are no two eyewitness accounts that completely match with anyone else's account. So that drawing an exact timeline saying, here is exactly who said what, did what, and was where at what time is almost impossible. I can tell you what historians believe, and the belief is that the Washington police officer who was supposed to be sitting outside of Lincoln's box left his post. He probably went down to the Star Saloon to have a drink. He was not prosecuted nor disciplined for doing that. Lincoln did
Crazy.
Not have
yeah.
the kind of 24-hour-a-day bodyguard service that we think of with contemporary presidents, but he was left unguarded in an unlocked box. Many witnesses in the theater saw John Wilkes Booth approaching the VIP box where Lincoln was sitting. Most of them didn't think anything about it. Some people in the theater recognized Booth. Those people who were theater habitués certainly recognized Booth, and several of them commented to their husbands, wives, dates, oh, look, there's John Wilkes Booth. You know, this is kind of exciting. This glamorous actor's going to go visit the president. Other people saw him approaching and didn't have any idea who he was, but didn't specifically perceive him as a threat. However, had the police officer held his post, it would have been much, much harder for Booth to have committed the murder. The reason why is the policeman, John Francis Parker, was armed and would have stopped anyone trying to come into the box if for no other reason than to ask them their business.
Mm-hmm.
Booth had only two weapons with him. The one was a single-shot Derringer, a pistol capable of firing one bullet. Had he needed it to kill the guard, he would have been unable to shoot Lincoln without reloading the gun after committing a murder that thousands of people would have heard. Secondly, Booth had a knife, a stiletto, and he had this very dramatic idea that if necessary, he would slit the throat of the guard. That would be very hard to do if a guard was facing you, was armed. Even if Booth had just lunged at him with a dagger, there would have been enough of a struggle where people sitting on, it was like the mezzanine level of Ford's Theater, would have immediately rushed over, and Booth couldn't have gotten in the box quickly. For that matter, the noise might have alerted Lincoln and Henry Rathbone that there was something going on outside the door. So while we don't know exactly where Parker is at the time of the assassination, we know that he's not where he should be.
And now, you know, it's interesting, too, all these things we're hearing about Booth, you know, having a one-shot Derringer, first of all, and just to have a knife to hold off people. You know, the plan itself just has obviously a lot of holes, like we talked about in the first segment. Yet he's able to, you know, I think we all know the story where he jumps from the state box after shooting Lincoln, unfortunately breaks his ankle. And was that because his spur hit the bunting? Was that what historians
have come up? We're
not sure. Okay.
Again, the witnesses in Ford's Theater that night did not agree.
Mm.
Some people thought that Booth had caught his spur on the bunting outside of Lincoln's box as he dramatically vaulted down to the stage to make his exit out the back door into the alleyway, onto a horse, and into, over the bridge to Maryland. However, Booth said that he was not hurt when he landed on stage, that in the dark on the ride, his horse had fallen on him and broken his ankle. And historians don't agree which one is more correct. But you would think with all of those witnesses sitting in the theater watching this unfold that there would be agreement, and yet there wasn't. And it's a good parallel to the Kennedy assassination where people standing along the parade route at Dealey Plaza weren't all in agreement about exactly what they saw or when they saw it. So what historians have to do is go with the weight of the evidence. What we do know is that by the time John Wilkes Booth has made it into Southern Maryland, that he has broken his leg just above his foot, is in tremendous pain, and will not be able to ride or walk anywhere easily until the bone heals.
Going back to the Ford's Theater, you said 1,500 people witnessed it, yet actually 1,500 people really didn't know when the shot went off. And correct me if I'm wrong, if that was even part of the play or not. Is that correct?
Well, yes.
I mean, they weren't really looking at Lincoln at the time, were they?
I believe the capacity of Ford's Theater that night was 1,700.
Oh, 17, okay.
You have to understand that...
But they weren't looking at Lincoln at the time, correct? I mean,
the play was going over wonderfully. Laura Keene had put on a terrific performance, as had the other actors on stage. The audience agreed that the play that night had been very, very funny, and that there was just an electricity in the air, partly because the president was there, partly because it was a completely packed house, partly because there was a great sense of relief that the war was over and it was okay to laugh again. As Booth shot Lincoln, there are a lot of things going on at that moment. Nobody much is looking at Lincoln at that moment because the action on the stage is reaching the denouement of the attack as the mistaken identities are being unraveled and hilarity is ensuing. Booth planned for himself to shoot on one specific line of dialogue in which everybody would be facing stage left and he was above their head stage right. When the shot took place, people heard the shot, but because a loud noise in a large enclosed theater will echo, people didn't necessarily know where the shot came from. It can take 15 minutes to describe what happens in the next 3 or 4 seconds. There's a loud shot, and people in the theater hear it, although some don't specifically hear it because they're laughing, applauding, or talking at that moment. Oh my gosh, wasn't that funny? They're applauding and laughing and having a great time. Some people in the back thought a shot had been fired on the street or a horse had knocked something over. Some people sitting in the front of the theater thought that a prop had fallen in the back. Some people in the theater, particularly some of the men who were Civil War veterans, recognized it as a shot but didn't know where it came from. It wasn't as if at the moment of the shot, everybody turned and looked up at Lincoln's box. At the sound of the shot, Major Rathbone jumped up and tried to stop Booth. Booth couldn't shoot his gun again, so he took his knife and slashed Rathbone's arm, causing him immense pain and bleeding. Rathbone dropped to the floor and couldn't do anything else. Mary Lincoln and Clara Harris begin screaming, and just as all of that is happening, Booth leaps to the stage very dramatically. Not all the audience saw him jump because they were still looking stage left at this funny line of dialogue. It's all happening very quickly.
Yeah, like you said, this is all split second. Yeah.
Booth got right in Mary Lincoln's face and said something, and then said something when he was on stage, and the witnesses couldn't agree what he said. Traditionally, he jumps to the stage, brandishes the knife, and says, "Sic semper tyrannis," the state motto of Virginia, "thus ever to tyrants." But some people say he says the South is avenged. Mary Lincoln isn't, and Clara Harris aren't consistent about what he says to her. So we can't say that exactly, but what we do know is that Booth lands on the stage. One man, at least from the audience, jumps up and starts running toward the stage to stop him. Booth barely escapes his clutches, gets on his horse, and heads to Maryland.
And that's interesting because here you have this guy with maybe a broken ankle, depending on what historian you believe, and he's riding out of town. It's amazing that he wasn't stopped before he reached Maryland.
Well, again, it has to be remembered that this is all happening very quickly. As your audience is listening to me describing this, it sounds like it's a 5-minute process because that's how long it took me to describe it. In essence, count it out in your head. There's a gunshot. Booth says something. There's a gunshot. Booth stabs Rathbone, says something to Mary, and leaps over the stage in the space of about 4 seconds, 5 seconds. And he doesn't stand there and continually stab Rathbone. He slashes him. Rathbone drops. He says something to Mary Lincoln. He vaults the stage. People are still laughing at the line spoken by Harry Hawke as the character Asa Trenchard that is considered the funniest line in the play. And this is all happening so fast. Booth says something to the audience and starts to leave. People are just reacting to it. What just happened? It takes a couple of beats for anyone to put two and two together as Mary Lincoln and Clara Harris start screaming. Joseph Stewart was a lawyer and a major in the Union Army. He had to get up the aisles and climb over the orchestra pit to get on stage. He's the nearest one from the audience to try and chase Booth. And as he's chasing Booth, he bumps into Harry Hawke, the actor, or William Withers, the orchestra leader, and he escapes.
So like you said, this is all so quick, yeah.
Anything happened slightly differently. If somebody on the stage had turned into Booth, he could have been caught right there. And from Booth's point of view, it would have been a dramatic moment because the audience would have recognized it was him.
It's interesting that Booth, like I said, was able to get to Maryland and then in his escape was able to receive help from a variety of people, and Dr. Samuel Mudd, for one, and then the smuggler Thomas Jones. I'd like to tell you, by the way, I think we're running a little bit short of time. And you know, once you talk about the Lincoln assassination, I'm discovering it's kind of a rabbit hole because, man, it just, there's all these different subplots that we haven't gotten into. We did set the stage a little bit in the beginning talking about the other conspirators, but I think we're going to run out of time here to really delve into Seward and Andrew Johnson and what took part at that point. I'm going to stick with Booth for right now, Barry. And so Booth takes off, and he goes to gets to Maryland and then receives help from Dr. Samuel Mudd. And what kind of assistance did Samuel Mudd give him? And then I have a question for you that's kind of bothering me about Dr. Samuel Mudd.
Samuel Mudd is a physician. Mm-hmm. He's a Southern sympathizer. He has met Booth on several occasions. Booth has spent the night in Mudd's house once previously. Hmm. There are reports that Booth had attended church with Mudd. Mudd would later claim he didn't know who Booth was and didn't recognize him.
Right.
It's that lie that is going to cause Mudd problems. Just, and going back to Mary Surratt for a moment, you were asking about her guilt. Louis Payne, one of the conspirators, was arrested standing in Mary Surratt's home, and the federal agents asked her, "Do you know this man?" And she denied knowing him, even though she knew him well, and he had addressed her by name. The lies, when criminal conspirators lie, they just add to the problem. Mudd sets Booth's leg and works with the terrorist network. Think of the Confederates in Maryland as a terrorist cell. They begin working to get Booth to safety. He can't stay in anyone's house. There is a massive manhunt out for him. There's a huge reward for him. He is shuttled, as you mentioned, by Thomas Jones to the home of a man named Cox. He hides out along the Zakiah Swamp. And eventually, the government catches up with many of the conspirators. Samuel Mudd winds up serving a prison term. And many of the conspirators are, even if not convicted, are arrested and put in jail for quite some time.
Real quick on Mudd, though, and this kind of gets back to my Mary Surratt question in the first segment. So it's interesting to me, and if you can clarify for me, this is where I'm real kind of confused, okay? So Mudd really is directly assisted Booth in the escapes, you know, set the leg and so forth. How was it that Dr. Mudd went to prison and then was later pardoned by Andrew Johnson a few years later, lived a normal life, while Mary Surratt was executed? And it just seems to me justice wasn't served there, and I know oftentimes it isn't, but how did that come about?
Mudd gives aid to a terrorist who has just murdered the president of the United States. His conviction is very appropriate. His sentence is to go to a desert prison island in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico called Dry Tortugas. Also sent there is Samuel Arnold, Michael O'Loughlin, and a couple others who were involved in the conspiracy to murder the president. While he was there, in the fall of 1867, a deadly outbreak of yellow fever swept the fort. It killed Michael O'Loughlin, who had been one of the kidnapping conspirators. The prison doctor died, and Samuel Mudd stepped forward and said, "I can help the prisoners. I'm a doctor." He did, and as a result, President Johnson decided to pardon him. He didn't declare him innocent. He simply said he can go home. The actual document signed by Johnson, the quote that I remember is, "He inspired the hopeless with courage and his constant presence in the midst of danger and infection." Mm. Many people owe their lives to him.
Okay.
So eventually, he was pardoned. That pardon comes later, but it is probably appropriate that he was pardoned at that point, but it is also perfectly appropriate that he was convicted.
And I guess I was trying, you know, we've just plumb run out of time, and I have so many more questions. One thing we didn't get into, not only just the Mary Surratt part and, you know, the equality of the conviction, but also the Secretary of War Stanton, we never got into the whole idea that he might have been, there's some historians who have alluded that he was orchestrating some of this conspiracy. There's just so much, and I want to tell you, Barry Bradford, you are, I could listen to you all day. Really could. Just fascinating. And Barry, we've just run out of time. I'm just so sorry, but thank you so much for being on Word of Mouth.
Well, it was my pleasure. And the question you were asking on the difference between Mary Surratt and Dr. Mudd is the fact that there is no proof that Mudd had prior knowledge of the assassination plots. He was a conspirator after the fact. It was a pleasure to talk with you and with all of your listeners. My website is www.barrybradford.com. I have a history blog there. If your listeners have any questions, they're welcome to send them to me via www.barrybradford.com. Also, on my history blog, they can access several very interesting articles about the Lincoln assassination.
Barry, again, just a pleasure talking to you, and thanks again for returning to the program.
My pleasure. Have a great day, Jim.
Thank you. And thank you for tuning in, and I hope you drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.